Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Hugo Rose. How are you, Hugo?
I'm good, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. You're with Culver Street, but you're the new chairman.
Well, I'm one of the founder directors of the Wine Investment Association, and I am chairman.
Perfect. And the Wine Investment Association was just launched today.
Indeed. 28th of November, we have formally launched the association. And in particular, we have published our code of practice. We're in a consultation phase and we're seeking views from members of the trade and anyone indeed related to wine investment and wine storage.
And when do you think the code will become official and you'll start? I suppose you don't trade, do you? But when does it get launched officially?
Okay, well, the consultation period runs up until the middle of January. We will then review as a body the replies that we've received and react as we see fit to those. And so that we will adopt the code formally on the 14th of February.
Well, it's November now, so it's, 3 months away? Sort of just under 3 months?
Yes, the clock is ticking. But we're keen to get the association and its code into public view. We're starting a membership process as well, so we're looking to build membership in order to gain a critical number of members who are working in the wine investment sector of the industry.
And you've already got 4 people on board. You've got Culver Street yourselves.
Yes, the core is the team who have been working on the association, its articles of association, the code of practice, complaints procedure, all of which are tied together. And so we've worked as a close-knit team. We share a common goal to bring the association to life, but clearly together we represent a rather small percentage of the industry. So it's our job from now to recruit members to our cause.
Okay, and what is the problem that the association is trying to solve?
It is something that is widely recognized that companies that store wine for their customers, if they fail for any reason, either through market circumstances or indeed mismanagement, sometimes worse, if the company hasn't obeyed certain processes and procedures, it is possible for the owner of wine not to receive their wine if the company goes bust.
How would that be? Give me an example.
So the company is most of the major wine merchants store wines for their customers. The wine is in bond. You can't do that yourself. So you require a company to provide the umbrella cellarage account for you. So they're looking after your wine. They're custodians of your wine. And if they haven't been careful to ensure that they have passed the title to that wine to you, and there are processes and procedures to do that, if that company gets into trouble and ultimately falls into administration, your wine is seen as an asset of the company, not as an asset that you own. And so instead of receiving your wine at that point, you find that you're an unsecured creditor.
And you're just in the queue to get a fraction
of
it back.
You may get 100% of your wine back with great relief. You may get 50 pence in the pound. You may get close to zero.
So it's not about trying to protect the consumer so far as from fraudulent behavior. It's more about trying to make sure that the people who are a part of the association have systems in place to ensure that if something goes wrong, it's okay.
Well, there is a link between the two. That is to say, a company that is adopting the right procedures, sound procedures and policies with regard to custody of customers' wines, even if there was fraudulent practice, following the code of practice would limit the risk of damage.
No, I was thinking more along the lines of some unscrupulous individuals in a boiler room just selling fictitious wine and never anticipating.
Well, I think it's unlikely that companies who have fraudulent objectives would want to join our association, and because an important plank of our program is what we call a compliance audit, where in order to become a member, they have to open up certain aspects of their books to external auditors to show that where a case is sold, a case actually exists. That is a filter that would I think a fraudulent company would not want to put itself through that filter.
Okay. I presume then that some companies, and I've heard this, you know, before On Premier even kicks off sometimes, you get people offering cases of wine that are not even available for sale at the moment. So that sort of thing couldn't occur under WLIA.
You're absolutely right to point out that the On Premier contract is a potential weak link. And that is where a lot of the fraud occurs, that either the wine was not actually ordered. We consider that fraudulent. The practitioners might say it's short selling, but I think that's wishful thinking on their part.
So you wouldn't support short selling as in the WIA?
Strictly speaking, in a financial sense, you have to have borrowed in order to sell short. I have heard the argument that a company has sold a case of wine, has not bought it, but intends to buy it later on. So that's a sort of form of short selling. We consider that unscrupulous, whatever happens. When you buy a case on Premier, you don't own it on the day you bought it. No. You own the right to have it delivered to you 2 years down the line. It doesn't exist on the day you bought it. So title can't pass until it's physically available and in this country. There is a confidence gap, if you like, and it's not possible to fill that entirely. What we do is, through our processes, the company has to show, the member has to show that that case has been ordered and there is a documented trail between sale to the customer backwards right up to placing the order for that wine.
And who is it up to? Is it up to, because On Premier is fraughtfully difficult with negotiants and all sorts of people in between the chateau and ultimately the trader who's selling the wine to you or I. Is it all backed up all the way to the chateau?
No, the chateau has no relationship with even the merchant in this country. And so they have no obligation to us at all. And that's true for a small trader or the largest wine company in the UK. They have no direct relationship with the chateau. The chateau has no obligation to them. The merchant in this country has a contract with a merchant in France.
Okay.
The merchant in France has a contract with the chateau.
Yep.
So the chateau doesn't know who in this country has bought its wine. I won't say it doesn't care, which is, that'd be wrong to say that, but they are not liable for a breakdown in that contractual relationship in the first instance.
No. But when you're doing an audit trail back, you would check that the seller of the wine or the seller of the On Premier wine would have a contract with the merchant in France.
The requirement is that they've placed a legitimate order which has been accepted by a merchant in France.
Okay.
And it can't go further back than that.
Okay, so you don't check if the merchant's fraudulent, it's just that they've placed an order.
No, I won't say it's not necessary to do that. I don't know how we would do that, but I don't think it adds protection because there's a contract. Contract is built up between the merchant and its customer, and our job through the audit process is to make sure that's a valid contract,
okay.
That it's substantiated with a valid purchase. It is true that things can go wrong. Actually, there could be a fire at the chateau, which might
wipe everything
out, prevent delivery of that wine, and we can't legislate against that. So there are limits to what our powers, if you like, and that applies not just to the Wine Investment Association's powers of audit, but the legal process stops with the next one in the chain.
Okay. All right. No, that's fine. Just so I understand where it is. You mentioned that it's got an independent audit. We're in the offices of Mazars at the moment, very salubrious that they are on Tower Bridge. They're the auditors for this that you said were going to do the audit trail checking inside the company's
yes,
part of
yeah, that. No, this is, for us, this is groundbreaking to require members to undertake an external audit of its processes. We call it a compliance audit, as distinct from a full financial or a company audit. A compliance audit to show that their processes hold water. Because you look at the evidence of companies that have failed, all of them have had processes that are not watertight and in some cases are downright deficient.
It's easy for a small company trying to get going to not have the processes in place because it takes time to build processes.
Well, that's right. I mean, you do need to have, even if you're a small company, to some extent you have to have a big company mentality when you are responsible for customers' stock. It's almost like a bank who is responsible for its clients' money. We are responsible. We are entrusted with the safekeeping of our clients' wine.
So let me understand the process. I'm a customer. I come up to Culver Street and I say, I want to buy some wine on Premier or just wherever, really. I'm not too worried about that. I give you a wad of cash because you want money up front usually. You hold on to that money until the wine's ready for delivery to you, and then you pay the merchant in France. Does that money go into an escrow account? Is that required, or does it just go into your general funds? Because that's where a lot of businesses often have problems. You know, the travel agency is a worst one for that until they made sure that everybody had to go into escrow accounts.
An escrow account would be very costly. I could see the potential advantages. It's not a practice that any wine merchant I know employs. So the payment does go into our commercial account. It goes into the bank account. Obviously, we are very concerned to pay our suppliers on time, and there are clear credit terms, whether it's 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, to pay for the on-premier orders. So they are paid up long before the wine comes for delivery.
Okay, so the money just comes into an account, and hopefully they've got enough money when they go to pay the bills.
Yeah, I mean, the bills are paid within 3 months of the launch, the sale of the on-premier. So it's not as though it's a two-year lag before that we're holding onto somebody's money for 2 years. It goes into our account, and the stage payments agreed with the négociants, if we're talking about France, and usually 30, 60, 90 days, or 60 days, 120 days is typical for the payment process.
What's the process if an auditor finds that the processes are not correct, you know, or the processes are lacking in some place? How do you encourage people to do the right thing?
Well, I think the requirement to submit to audit once a year, it's not just a one-time only, once a year will certainly have a profound effect in more than encouraging companies to improve their standards and of conduct and their processes. It will, almost at a stroke, raise the professional bar. But the question is, you've asked, is what happens if a company is found wanting in any respect? Well, I have to say, none of us yet have, well, we are going to be the guinea pigs for this. So I think there's going to be some discovery involved as to where judgments need to be made, what is the wiggle room, if you like, because I'm sure no company is going to get a completely clean bill of health first time out.
No.
The auditors work to standards, work to our instruction. They don't have a view as to whether this customer is nearly there or is they're either there or not in terms of what they're required to deliver. If a less than clean bill of health comes back, then the association has to decide whether, well, it's a little bit like a complaint. Okay, this is the report, you're deficient in this area. Either you clean it up or you're not a member. So we will give the prospect of remediation, of making good. I think that's only reasonable. We have to act reasonably. So there'll be an opportunity to make good, and then I'm thinking slightly ahead of ourselves here, a second visit from the auditor to confirm that that area has been rectified. If a company doesn't achieve an acceptable compliance audit on the first day, if it's a small deficiency, it seems reasonable to ask them to put it right.
Yeah.
If it's a substantial deficiency, they go back to the beginning again. They throw a six and start again. They're not members until they have passed.
I was going to say that you must pass the audit first before you can become a member.
Yeah, I mean this is strong medicine, but our view is that risk and hazard in the industry is sufficiently significant as to require strong medicine.
And can you impose fines or anything? What is the strongest medicine you can dish out?
Well, we're not a fining organization. Let us say a company is a member. If they're not a member, by the way, we have no sanctions against them. We can't adjudicate or legislate for, shall we say, the bad boys of the industry. Our job is to identify the good guys and encourage them to join the association, albeit having to jump up to a certain height to do that. If they are a member and are then in breach of the code, they then are responsible for following the code of practice. and obeying the code of practice. So we move into the second stage now. Now that they've passed the compliance audit hurdle, they're now into the world of the code of practice. They have to adhere to the tenets of the code. And this is where we have the potential to not to penalize, but to deliver sanctions against those companies who, where a complaint is made against them, that they are in breach of the code. And that's where we now move on to our independent panel who will sit in judgment, who will adjudicate on complaints. So complaints will normally come from customers of those companies. And it might be, I was given the wrong advice. I was told that this was a long-term investment, and it turns out it's a short-term. It might be that worst-case scenario, well, there are a number of areas of the code which could lead to complaints. But let us take, I was sold the 05 vintage of Leuven-Lascasse, and my stock record shows it's the 04. And I don't consider that they're same as each other. They're not of equal merit. The merchant insists that I agreed to buy the 04. I'm pretty sure I agreed to buy the 05. I've got the paperwork to prove it. They won't see my argument. And so they may then make a complaint to the association because one of our members, they believe, is in breach of the code.
Yep.
They're not meeting a specific clause in the code. Normally, we will ask the member what they think about this first. They have a right of reply, effectively. We'll pass it back to the member in the first instance. We're not going to come down. We're not going to throw the full weight of the law until it's clear that there's not going to be a meeting of the minds. So if the member is unable to satisfy the complaint, the complainant, then the complaint is then sent to the independent panel who will sit in judgment on that complaint. And they have a range of sanctions open to them from a requirement that certain changes are made, or escalating up to a publication of the adjudication, in other words, naming and shaming, but still keeping the member on board, and obviously a requirement to remedy the complaint, and ultimately the sanction is expulsion.
Okay, so you can't fine or put anything?
No, that takes us into a different realm. Because it's a code of practice, the member has to abide by it, and there's no failing to abide but paying a fine.
You can't pay
your way out of jail.
Oh no, but I'm thinking of cases in the is it the PCC where if you, maybe the Telegraph did something, they can still be fined as well as named and shamed.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm slightly out of my depth in terms of the constitutionally the differences between that organisation and ours. I suspect they don't expel members, and therefore they have to have their ultimate sanction is a hefty fine. The fining route takes us legally into a different water. I think we like to be very clear-cut. You either correct area of complaint, so to bring you back in line with the code, or you can't be a member.
Okay. And who appoints this panel? How's the panel made up?
We recognise that credibility required that it wasn't merchants sitting in judgment on merchants.
No, that was what the PCC did. So you can't have that.
Well, it is problematic, shall we say. In some instances it might be right. We've decided that it is inappropriate and we need a degree of impartiality. We are a trade-led organization, so the only way we can do that is to bring people in from the outside. So we are right now recruiting lawyers, compliance professionals, accountants. We need to have four sitting on the panel. We're probably going to have to recruit six in order to do that. We'll then lodge their details with our lawyers so that it's a good question you've raised. The panel, the identity of the panel needs to remain anonymous. We could be exposing them to reputational risk if their names were in the ether. We tell the world what their backgrounds are, and we lodge their details with our lawyers.
Why can't you make it public? I've been involved in the energy industry, and we had a sort of a governance body that this is in New Zealand, where the governance body was set up by the industry. It was quite a soft governance body, but even so, the people who were when problems occurred, we all knew who the people were that were making the judgment. What's the risk?
We're at an early stage, but our view is that in the professional field, we're actually asking these people to work for nothing right now. I think anonymity of the process, there are reasonable precedents for that, but it is essentially to protect them from reputational risk, and indeed, at the extreme, protect them from being approached.
Who appoints them?
Well, we have a nominations committee. Right now, of course, it's overlaps with the board of directors because we're, as yet, a small group. But the nominations committee will have formal responsibility to appoint and therefore to appoint wisely.
How do you sit the nominations committee?
Well, it is three members of the board, and there are currently four directors in the board. So it will be three members out of the four right now. We're growing the board. Our objective is to have eight board members.
Yeah.
And so it will be, they'll be selected from the directors of the association.
And on the board itself or in the panel, is there anybody that represents the consumer per se? I know it's an industry body, but do you have any consumer advocates there, like Which or any sort of organization?
I think we're still at an early stage. Right now, our feeling is that it should be a professional adjudication. I think we'll take a view on that. I mean, we're now entering a consultation process, and if we get a loud noise that says you must have somebody who has particular skills in consumer rights, for example, then we'll listen to that. I think the jury is slightly open on that, but the key principle is independence of the wine industry. People who understand the issues, because they're professional in that area, but they have nothing to do with anyone in the industry whose cases they might be adjudicating on.
What about the board itself? Is it all just wine people, or is there any independent people on the board?
You're looking at a quarter of it right now. So the board right now is four practitioners from the wine industry.
This is
self-regulation, and it is so. It's a very important tenet for us that it's an industry-led organization. I mean, there is scope down the line for hypothetically non-executive directors, but I think we're some way away from that yet.
Okay.
Our job is to build the membership, to build critical mass, to build confidence and awareness and belief in our objectives, that they make sense and we can deliver them. I hear what you're saying about... whether we'll go down the route of independent directors. Right now, our view is not to, because it is the trade taking responsibility for itself. The independence right now comes from the adjudication panel.
Yeah, I'm just wondering who really represents the consumer, and the adjudication panel does, but at the same time, it's appointed by the board who's... So it's a wee bit, you know, circular in terms of that. You know, it's like it's a bit like, you know, being appointed a peer by the prime minister. It's great, but he's never going to appoint someone who opposes him.
I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad
analogy
there. No, I think I hear what you're saying. Our view is that a healthy industry is good for both the practitioners in the industry and its customers.
Yeah,
and it's a it's a long way better than we are today.
I think we'll wrap it up there, Hugo. Thank you very much for your time.
Great pleasure.
Cheers.